It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Shot Podcast. I'm Joe Dyer, and I'm here today with Charles Firth in Sydney.
Hello.
We have Dave Milner down in Melbourne.
G'day.
Unfortunately, Grace Tame is off being Grace and is saving the world in the Northern Territory today, so won't be joining us. But do we have a substitute for her for you? We are delighted to have back on the podcast Ronnie Salt.
Oh, hello. I don't think I'm any substitute for the glorious Grace, but I hope I suffice.
Well, I think our listeners will be thrilled to hear your dulcet tones today, Ronnie. With you here, we're going to dive into the article that you published for The Shot this week, which was, in typical, beautiful, eloquent Ronnie words, a takedown of the opposition leader, the politician that's never there, Peter Dutton, on holiday this week, it seems, conveniently. But he seems to be doing yet another attempt to reinvent himself so that we can forget the 22 years that he's been in public life and he can be Mr. Happy, Friendly Peter Dutton, ex-Queensland Police, and not racist, horrific, soulless Peter Dutton. Do you think it's working?
Refugee child, torturer, yeah. Peter Dutton.
Yeah, not that, no. He's the
not
man
that
who,
guy.
He's the man who loves families.
You've got him wrong. You've only got to watch his video. I mean, look at him. He's, you know, he barbecues with his family and chases his cattle around. What more is there to ask about him?
But you wouldn't want to judge him on his actions or his words. You should judge him on his softly lit YouTube videos.
Well, he's entered that territory that you know, territory that many, many, many male politicians long before him have entered, which is to, when times are tough, drag out the wife and kids and drag out the friends and go and have a beer and, you know, whatever else.
Jenny and the girls,
exactly. You know, even Bob Hawke liked to, you know, mind you, Hazel Hawke was very, very popular. But, you know, they all do it. But it was interesting that it seemed to be, when I was researching the article, there seemed to be a bit of a coordinated attack on that week. You know, there were lots of articles about how Peter Dutton had arrived. And I think I mentioned one in the article, which I found unintentionally hilarious, which was that Peter Dutton will be the next Prime Minister of Australia, which I thought was incredibly optimistic.
Very optimistic, one would have to say, when one looks at his tanking poll numbers, despite the way that they're spun by the likes of Simon Benson. He continues to be languishing at the bottom of kind of Mr. Asterix almost.
Dear old Simon, yeah. Look, it's not that he's done anything unusual, I suppose, in doing that, although, mind you, it is a very expensive, glossy, sort of video. It's more the fact why.
That's what I found interesting, though. Like, it is a very, very it was well produced. You and I talked about this when we were talking about the piece. I don't think it will matter very much because we are talking about a man that's been in public life for a very long time and has a track record of just being an asshole. And I mean, the last time he did a really significant PR push resulted in that "I'm not a monster" front page, which is if you're saying that and that's your attempt to redefine yourself, you are starting from well behind the starting line.
Yeah,
right?
If that's your big selling point, you clearly don't have much with which to burnish your reputation.
Yeah, we're starting from the fact that, you know, could bring wife out to say I'm not a monster. And I think Charles, that just said then, you know, Jen and the girls. I know that was a great trick of Morrison's, Jen and the girls. But the core issue with all of this frippery about sitting in a beer, having a beer with someone, or, you know, going down the shop and having a coffee or whatever it is, that has zero relevance to the policies and procedures that they enact as a politician on behalf of Australia and behalf of the nation. So I don't give a bugger how nice Peter Dutton is to his dog And I don't care. Obviously, his wife thinks he's wonderful. I mean, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 kind of thing. But as we referenced with Jen and the girls, there was so much that went on with Scott Morrison's wife and Scott Morrison's daughters, who I firmly believe children should be kept out of things anyway. But the fact that none of that really had any relevance to any of the decisions that they made. So what if he's nice to his wife? No, so what? No, but he's still locking up refugees.
But isn't – no, for me, I thought it was a bit newsworthy because – I thought it was incredible that anyone would like Scott Morrison. Like even his wife. Like that to me was why it was front page news. It was like, no, there is actually somebody who likes him. Like, honestly. Like, really honestly does.
Only like
woman
three people.
Scott Morrison, that's the headline.
But this is where, I think you're onto something, right, which is I don't understand why Peter does. Like, clearly he's not going to win on I'm a nice guy, I'm not a monster. Like it's sort of, isn't all the stuff he's done too far gone now?
He needs to own being a monster and try to be a better monster.
Marketing 101 is you lean into whatever your true essence is. And so you go, yeah, I'm an evil monster. I'm the tough guy.
I will
who
be
locks
your
up.
Evil monster.
Yeah, I'll be your evil monster. You don't want to be me, but you know, because I think Australia had that a little bit with John Howard, where they didn't particularly like him. They thought he was really mean, but he was sort of mean on our behalf.
I mean, just can we note parenthetically, was wheeled out again by the Australian this week, John Howard, on the occasion of his 84th birthday. And if there's anything worse perhaps than watching the video of Peter Dutton, it was reading an interview between Janet Albrecht and John Howard. Saying yet again all of his...
What are you doing to your mental
health? I know, like but it's saying all again his normal kind of racist motifs, as if somehow by being older and more doddery, he's going to have transformed into someone who has anything relevant at all to say about Indigenous rights and the voice. Let us recall this was the man who hectored the delegates of the Reconciliation Convention rather than delivering a national apology. And I think his key achievement in the Indigenous portfolio was to set the army onto communities in the central desert. So I don't know why we're listening to him on this. But anyway, that was just a little aside as we'll get back to Dutton, who it is interesting to note is actually on leave this week on holidays and so has not yet had to answer to all of the allegations coming out of the Nine press about the fact that on his watch, none of this is surprising, but actually now there does seem to be documentary evidence that on his watch, massive bribes were paid to the Pacific politicians who were overseeing our gulags. Mm. And so there was yet again a transfer of Australian taxpayers' dollars to, you know, really egregious kind of and overflowing bank accounts for people to keep that kind of concentration camp turning over. So it'll be interesting to see if he will have to answer to that and if Labor can actually lay a glove on him for, you know, what should be a really easy knockout blow, but ones that Labor never seemed to quite be able to land.
Do you think that's going to happen, though? Do you think somebody's going to chase him through a car park or, you know, like, do you think he's...
I don't think they will. And I wonder, Ronnie, perhaps it'd be great to get your insight on this. Do you think that part of that is obviously that the media do seem to amplify anything critical of the government or before that when the Labor Party were in opposition as opposed to the Conservatives? And obviously that's because, you know, we've got Murdoch, we've got Nine, we've got West Media, all of whom have a conservative bent, if not agenda. Or do you think it is that we're so inured to the horrors that really were the detention centres in the Pacific and that we're just not surprised? Because actually we did deep down know that this stuff was going on all along and we just accepted it and it became normalised within the political environment and discourse. So that now that it's coming out with documentary evidence, it's like, a bit of a shrug of the shoulders because we knew this all along.
Yes, all of that. Mm. Yeah, the last bit especially. Because one of the things, you know, I was going to say when I first opened up the media in the last few days and read all of that was exactly what you said, you know, a shrug of the shoulders and so what?
Mm.
Because I'm not sure the impact is going to be as large as Ninefacts would like it to be, purely because that's something that's been out in the public sphere for a while, that the whole show was dodgy. I mean, even as recently as we, you know, we see the Albanese government continuing on with that.
I think that's part of a reason as well why Dutton won't be pursued too stridently on this. It's extremely bipartisan, this policy of gulags, basically. And it's not that surprising that our offshore prison camps for foreign children fleeing war aren't run to the highest meticulous ethical standards, is it?
Well, see, here's a question. I think it was a month or two ago. There were a number of people on social media having a discussion, and one of them who came out and questioned the fact that there had been a budget allocation of $345 million made for the refugee camps, asylum seeker camps in Nauru. Now, essentially, there's nobody there in the asylum. It was a $345 million. I don't have it in front of me, but I'm going from memory. Now, nobody's there, and the camp is closed, essentially. I mean, you know, when I say it's closed, obviously the facilities are still there, and I'm sure there's a lonely, you know, custodian wandering around checking the fences or what have you. But when you talk about that annual sum of $345 million, what you're actually talking about is payola to the Nauru government.
Yes.
Let's be honest. It's not, there's no one there. It's not going to food. It's not going to security guards. It's not going to cleaners. Nothing is happening. Absolutely nothing is happening. That money is going towards appeasing the Nauru government, who within their own parliament actually come forward and say that tourism and the Australian, I forget what they call it, you know, the Australian asylum seeker industry or what have you, are their two main sources of income.
Mm.
So, and that's the Albanese government doing that. So, yes, you're right. It's and they've signed up to it. So it's not something that's a surprise, particularly to people who've been following these types of things. So whether it has any major impact, who knows, because it doesn't have that cut through. It's not like, oh, my God. Who would have thought?
But it is interesting because, I mean, some of that money went directly from the owner of Paladin to his mother. He paid him $1.2 million. Yes. And initially that was invoiced for consulting services. And when that was uncovered through investigation, he went, oh, no, that was a mistake. Yeah, no, it was just a gift. There is this sort of, again, this direct transfer of public money to private profits, whether it goes to the Nauru politicians, much of it did, or actually directly into the bank accounts of the owners of these very dodgy companies. And let's remember that at the time they were being awarded like literally multi-million dollar companies. One of them had, you know, its registered office and a shack on Kangaroo Island.
Yes.
And so all of this stuff which has been swirling around for so long is now being documented through the Nine papers. And surely the NAC at least can investigate this, even if that's not going to be the, you know.
And I wouldn't underestimate the power of a yarn. Like I tend to agree that Australians sort of, there is a sort of shrug of the shoulder element to it, but we like our bastardry to be done with a bit of plausible deniability. Like what we don't want is it to be completely explicit. Like as soon as we find out that the dodgy person who we elected repeatedly was actually dodgy, we then go, oh no, that was terrible. Well, we don't like that. Right. And there's some great yarns coming out about this Dutton stuff. The best one for me was when the AFP went and briefed Peter Dutton as Home Affairs Minister a couple of months beforehand and said, this guy, this particular guy is the dodge fest, right? Like he is corrupt, right? And then a couple of months later, Dutton's own ministry goes, okay, he's the guy, right? And it's almost like just from a storytelling perspective, like the AFP, like I think that there were two conversations going on. Like the AFP were going, you know, this guy's dodgy, and with the subtext, you probably shouldn't deal with him. And and Dutton was hearing, this guy's dodgy.
Yeah.
He's the one. They found him. They found the right guy.
No, that's
thanks
exactly
for headhunting him.
And what's more is that it seems clear that these were all verbal briefings, and that came out yet again, both through this briefing, but also the doctor who was working on Nauru, and he was he was basically has now blown the whistle on the fact that he was told you're not supposed to put any of these things in writing. So you just see this kind of multifarious layers.
But I think that's actually
bastardry.
Fair enough, because if they put it in writing, PwC would have got their hands on it at some point and then sold it to somebody else.
That is true.
So
this is a relevant point, Charles. Like, the other reason this impact is damaged, is like muted, is because it is literally just the way the entire world works at the moment, where public money is funneled off to private hands in increasingly dodgy, increasingly gobsmacking fashion.
I know, but I mean, I have to say, like, this idea that from the head of Paladin literally just transferred $1.2 million of our money into his mum's bank account is just like, while she also was working for Home Affairs, it's just like, God.
Maybe I'm too cynical. I assume that's happening all the fucking time.
Like, yeah. but that level of cynicism's not actually useful. Like, isn't a sort of more useful thing to say, and isn't it a missed opportunity that Labor didn't actually bother to hold these crooks to account and be able to get into power 3 years earlier, because they actually did their homework and showed people who were just blatantly being crooks to be crooks? You know, like, don't you think, like, I know.
Yeah, but Charles, you're missing the point. They've got to have their little moment to be crooks.
I do think if they had basically blown the whistle on these crooks who were involved with this kind of shameful policy that was taking place on the Pacific Islands, then the whole thing would have unravelled. Nobody wanted to do that, and they all thought the political cost of doing that would be too high.
I refuse to believe that the majority of our parliament gets into public office to basically make hay and be corrupt, right? Like,
oh, no, I agree with you there.
I actually think they do go in there, and then a culture clearly from the coalition executive emerged, which was just deeply corrupt, but they sort of took hold of those measures of power, and I think it was a sort of a crack unit of corruption that was running the whole government. Yeah, you're right, that was terrible. But I just do not, I refuse to believe that the current government wants to make their own sort of thing. In fact, I would say they're annoyingly the other way around, where everything has to be a process rather than let's actually stop climate change and all that. It's like, no, we've got to go through a 10-year transition project where we listen to industry stakeholders and not do anything ever.
Trying to upset nobody while the world burns.
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, we shall see whether or not they make this. I mean, because it is the leader of the opposition who was the minister responsible when all of this was taking place. So there should be much political capital that can be made of this whilst doing the right thing.
But his wife loves him.
And he is not a monster.
And he's not a monster.
And his cows. Don't forget the cows.
Yes.
His cows.
Well, we shall see. When he gets back from leave, I think next week it is, shortly before he then appears on Kitchen Cabinet with
They've really done everything, haven't they?
Yes. That's what I was saying. There's a real PR drive going on there. I mean, he's going to, he's going to show us his apple pie recipe, and you know, I mean, I can't wait. I just can't wait.
We should launch a second podcast called Softball, and invite him on that.
I have heard though, in relation to his appearance on Kitchen Cabinet, is that initially he was being Mr. Charming, Mr. Witty, and everybody was being a bit disconcerted. But then when it did get into the policy, he couldn't help himself and he turned right back into the enormous cunt that we know him to be.
Right. Yeah, no, because it is true. Like, I know a couple of restaurant owners up in Canberra, and they say out of all the politicians, and they said, we hate Peter Dutton, but out of all the politicians, he's by far the nicest and most charming.
He comes in,
he's very charismatic.
So. Yeah, he saves his appalling behaviour for those who suffer under his policies. So
is that right, Charles?
Yeah, that's...
And guess who the rudest is? Guess who the rudest person is? Penny Wong.
Oh, gosh, there's a big field.
Yeah, no, Penny Wong apparently is very rude, very abrupt with all the staff.
Oh, I think that's just because she's quite aloof and she keeps distance. I don't think she would be intentionally rude.
But how's it received by the people working for her?
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I'm sure she's just thinking about more important matters, but it's still, sure. You know, it's still that's
like
just
foreign policy.
Human, yeah.
Nuclear war, yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting, Charles, that you make that point because, yes, the people I may or may not know inside the Federal Liberal Party all say that he's quite popular.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I think that was the thing that we've referenced before is that when the leadership, you know, before poor old Josh lost his seat, there is that sense that everybody thought Josh was a nice guy and Dutton was an arsehole, whereas actually personality-wise, Dutton is supposed to be quite charming and Josh very thin-skinned and brittle.
Mm.
But from a policy point of view, obviously one is marginally worse than the other of a poor package.
You can't be a childhood tennis star and not be an arsehole.
Is that a rule?
That's actually a rule.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's the John McEnroe rule of arsehollery, especially an Australian tennis childhood star.
Yeah, well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it was a man who's been disappointed early by not going on to be number one in the world. So he's
a man in waiting too, Josh Frydenberg, but that's a whole other issue.
Look, that is a whole other issue. I will be interested to see if he bothers to run again.
We'll be waiting for him too.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The other big news of this week for those of us who remain, you know, we are the last holdouts still on Twitter, was to see our dear little bird disappear. It literally from 1 second to the next, the little bird was gone and we have this, you know, rather ominous looking X. Is that the last straw for us on Twitter, do we think? And I'm looking at with Ronnie and Dave, both of whom have, you know, painstakingly and through your own Twitter activism and more general engagement online, have built really large followings. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it, for trying to find substitutes, whether through Threads or, you know, Blue Sky or wherever. Mastodon seems to have just quietly gone away, I note. That you're basically having to sort of start all over again with building followers, albeit with much more name recognition than perhaps at the start of our Twitter adventures. What do you think?
I think it's an important lesson that you do need to own as much of your own channels as possible, because the whims of a, you know, insecure billionaire could take that away from you at any given moment. And I think that's a key reminder, because what's happening at Twitter is, you know, in a lot of senses, it's irrational. It's like you've bought a brand that has X value. I mean, you've worked steadily at chipping away at that value, but it is still valuable. And then to change it completely into something that a coked up marketing executive in the late 90s would come up with after like fucking rollerblading into work is bonkers.
I can see that marketing executive. I think I used to work for them. The ponytail, little ponytail at the back.
Oh, yeah, my God, remember
really
them.
Proactive and that sort of vibe. And it's what it will do to that community is just going to be interesting. What it has definitely done is destroyed the natural flow of conversation on Twitter. That was one of the things that I think was the genius of it, was that someone would say something interesting, the interesting stuff would get responded to, the boring stuff would get ignored. And in that way, it sort of mirrored a natural conversation of drunk people in a pub.
Mm. Yeah.
And then you've changed that system where you're allowing the uninteresting people that never get listened to get paid to get listened to, and it completely derails the conversation because you have to scroll down for the first interesting thing, and by that point, because Twitter has already rotted your attention span, you've lost interest, and then it just dies.
Yeah, it's true. It's a really interesting dilemma. I mean, we still call it Twitter. I actually prefer the Chinese pronunciation of it. I like the X-I-T-T-E-R, the shitter. I like that. I think we should morph into that. But, yeah, it is really interesting. You're talking about, you know, your own channels and how you should sort of own and look forward to, because it's a real dilemma, Joe, because I can't talk about specifically some of the things where I know I've had an impact on there are things that I've said and tweeted about and threads and so on Twitter where I absolutely know they've had an impact because the information's been given back to me.
Yep.
I won't go into a whole range of reasons, but it's once you do have a voice and once you work out how to drive that voice and that power, you can have quite an impact if you want to. I'm not talking about, you know, obviously changing the world or what have you.
No, but in its own way, absolutely.
You listen to and what have you. So it's a very reluctant choice we're having to make because, I don't know what's wrong with Elon Musk. I won't even begin to try and understand. I mean, take a psychology degree and then some, but it's very difficult to try and make those choices and walk away because on the one hand you're making an impact and you're saying things and helping things and what have you, and then you turn around and think to yourself, why am I here with this sort of emerald mining incel who's, you know, I think the last thing I saw he was tweeting about vaccines or something rather causing the death of some US basketball son's, 18-year-old.
Oh, yes, LeBron James's son had the heart attack. I think they were trying to blame that on
and he was casting aspersions about whether it was or wasn't or not due to the vaccine. An 18-year-old boy, he didn't know it. You know, I mean, it's just shit.
Yeah.
His mouth just spouts ass gravy. And so I've got no idea what his agenda is. I think I've got a suspicion what his agenda is. And certainly on the surface, he appears to be wanting to create this sort of, you know, multi-platform channel. But there's certainly a few other sort of agendas at play behind the scene. But
well, and there's precious little evidence to suggest, given that all he seems to be doing is tearing things down and actually devaluing and disrupting the service that Twitter was providing, the idea that he's competent enough or has the patience enough to build up this take over the world kind of WeChat for the West kind of world where, you know, you've got financial, like, why would we trust financial details to the, you know, Twitter 3.0 or whatever so much of it is already kind of grinding to an incompetent halt.
But I think you're mistaking him wanting to do it with saying that he wants to do it, because I think what Elon has forever depended on, his business model is not capitalist accumulation like you sort of, you know, we've had for 150 years where you mix labour with capital and then you create a surplus and then reinvest that money. What his business model has always been, for all his projects, has been pump and dump capitalism, where you create a vision of something where you raise a whole lot of money around the expectation that could be incredibly valuable, and that's the whole game.
Yeah.
And as long as you keep coming up with something more and more extreme and more big, like with the X
while acquiring government grants en masse.
Yeah,
as well.
With the X app, it's hilarious. He said that the potential market value should be based on the fact that we'll own half of all transactions in the world, right? and so you go on a risk reward ratio. It is completely rational for an investor to go, well, Elon has pulled things out of his ass before. Even if there's a 1 in 1,000 chance of that winning, actually putting $10 billion into the chance at owning essentially the world. Dr. Evil. Type.
For the record, Charles did the evil pinky up to me.
I think with Twitter, what he's done, and it's very crypto, right? Like, It's a sort of crypto thing of, it doesn't matter that there's no underlying value to any of these crypto coins, like Dogecoin and stuff like that. It's just like you create a sort of adrenaline hit that everyone pays attention to, and so that it goes up, and then you take the money out while everyone's attention is there, and then you just come up with something else to make it, you know, give it attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what's happening with Twitter. He's replaced a sustain, because I read this really interesting thing by somebody who used to monetize, like worked out how to monetize YouTube's community properly, right? And that is a sustainable business model. It's all based on, well, the we know what how much value each, you know, creator creates for the platform, and we'll give them enough of a cut that they can keep doing it sustainably. Whereas Twitter has done these essentially airdrops of money to all these Nazis, basically. Yeah. And it was this really interesting thing saying they are, those are not sustainable drops of money. Elon is not making $40,000 out of the sort of
That's not an ongoing plan. It's quite clearly hype to sell more subscriptions. Mm. And the other thing it's doing is, like,
it's turning it into a lottery. It's turning it, like,
But that is enticing to the human mind, though. Like, it's that random nature of reward that most hooks people to any platform. That's how slot machines work.
Yeah.
So that's what, that's the enticement to the brain. And the other part of it is that the people that he is paying money to, people like Ian Miles Chong, who, you know, isn't a Nazi, but he is a like a primary school tier right-wing troll. He is, like, he's very much buying their allegiance in the culture war for whatever Twitter becomes. He is buying. Mm. I mean, imagine if a journal, imagine if I was accepting $16,000 and then writing about the guy that gave me $16,000. Like, you would have so much right to tell me to shut the fuck up and not read a word I said.
Mm.
And these are the people that will shape the discourse around whether the new Twitter is good or not. And they're literally being paid right now. To not explicitly to say it's good, but they will.
So and I think too, the bar for that is very high. I got a very nice email from Shitter asking me if I wanted to become a paid content provider, and you know, all of these wonderful things. And all I had to do was have a minimum of 5 million impressions per month. So that.
But you do that. I'm sure I do that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I won't go, I do get 5 minutes.
Sign up, Ronnie.
But I mean, that's not achievable for, you know, 99.9% of the general user base of Twitter. So that's one of the first things is that, you know, they're talking about their wonderful, you know, business model and how you can get paid for content and so on. But almost, you know, I don't know how many worldwide users there are of Twitter, but that it would be in the hundreds of millions, would it?
200 million.
I mean, that's just not the reality for most people who use it. So it's not sustainable. It's a public relations exercise or what have you, but, you know.
And it's certainly not the reality for most people that are paying for Twitter Blue, which is the precursor, and you know, most of those accounts are very low quality, very low engagement.
Well, that's just the mark of the fuckwit now, isn't it? No, it's the mark of the fuckwit. I mean, to me, it's just like, it's like a big noose.
It's a kick me sign.
Yeah, it's a red flag it's a big, right there.
Sort of thing. Look, I've got some good friends on Twitter who are good, really good, decent people and great users of the platform who have paid for their blue tick purely because they want to dig in and not give in and not secede to, you know, they realize that their influence is going to wane. And certainly I toyed with the idea for a while too, until, you know, I went and looked at Elon Musk's latest tweet, and then I decided perhaps.
Well, I think that is the thing, and I ask of you two, particularly Dave and Ronnie, do you think you will be there until the ship really goes down for all of the reasons that we've just talked about, and not the least of which as well because, you know, there is within the wider Twitter usage, there are now important communities that we've all forged. Yeah. Links, yeah. You know, we've all made friends on Twitter that have then crossed over into relationships in real life. It's
absolutely
there is that dual thing of, like, as you say, Ronnie, you on the one hand you don't want to lose that, and you want to dig in and say fuck you, Elon Musk, you're not going to kill this for us. But then on the other hand, you read his latest tweet and you think, what are we still doing here?
I think I just need to, like, detach a little bit emotionally and manage it differently. I can't walk away from a car crash that's happening. I'm inherently interested in car crashes. It's just something my brain does. So I will be there as it sinks. I I never considered paying for the blue tick, mostly for like hyper embarrassment reasons, but also, you know, principle. I just think it's lame. There's not even a high moral principle. I just think it's kind of fucking lame. So I will suffer the loss in engagement and all of that sort of thing. Like I just don't care. It is interesting though. Every time I write about Twitter, I see a very natural. It runs away. It spikes, and then about 15 minutes after that, it gets throttled, and it's quite noticeable. It's an interesting thing that we'll have to manage.
And then the other thing is that at this stage there isn't a strong viable alternative.
No.
I mean, if Meta and Zuckerberg had their act together, Threads would have been well on the way to killing Twitter. But who knows, that transition may still happen. I think you've got to give Threads at least 12 months.
Mm.
You know, it's interesting to see how many people jumped on there, particularly legitimate journalists, celebrities, you know, mainstream organisations. I think Oprah's.
And it's interesting to see that these people are kind of playing like they used to play on Twitter. There's definitely a lighter mood over there.
Yes.
And that might actually be the thing that helps it, because, like, you actually do need to want to spend time on these platforms. And I find that every time I hop on Twitter, it does not improve my mood. It does not improve anxiety.
But
levels.
The thing that
Threads has a different effect.
What it needs to do really quickly is that it needs to develop a desktop version. So for journalists and so on who are actually working on their computers, like just nipping onto Twitter for a while is really straightforward when there's a desktop version.
Definitely.
But as if not more importantly, it needs a hashtag facility where you can follow conversations, because a lot of Twitter... Some of the best times I've had is when we're all watching the same AFL game, when we're all getting stuck into whoever's being interviewed by David Spears on Insiders. You know, these are really important functions that at the moment Threads, and no one that, you know, Mastodon didn't have it. Like there's no one that seems to be able to replicate that experience as yet. And it needs to happen quickly before we lose interest, because Threads certainly seem to me... I think it just
tied
quickly
to that
as a
is
result of the
chronology of the platform.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's also a fundamental misunderstanding of whether there is or not, whether they know this and they're just choosing to ignore it. But the functionality of the two platforms, you know, Instagram is visually based.
Yeah.
And visually based, and people add some pretty words to it or what have you. And a lot of people bag the gram and say, oh, it's full of, you know, duck-lipped, you know, Botox people or what have you, but there's some really interesting activism that's happening on Insta as well. Not necessarily in great deal, but it's not a text-based format.
No.
And when you were talking about the desktop version, Joe, you're exactly right. One of the things that really stops me from diving into Threads full time is that you know, I can sometimes write threads that total, you know, 2,000-3,000 words. And I'll be stuffed if I'm going to be sitting there on my mobile doing that.
Doing it with your thumbs.
Or, you know, I'm not old enough to own an iPad yet. So, I turn into an iPad user. So there's a, and you're right. I mean, some of the best times that I've ever enjoyed on Twitter have been, you know, collectively bagging Barnaby Joyce when he's appearing on Q&A or something.
Yeah.
On Insiders. I mean, you know, moments of high hilarity. So yeah, and you can't do that without having some sort of joint hashtag and some sort of you know, base community where you can meet each other and chinwag about that. And so there seems to be a lack of understanding of what Threads is about. And I was alarmed to see that the CEO of Threads, in the first day or two that it opened, talked about the fact that they wanted Threads to be less about politics and activism and interaction and more about discussing fashion. Yeah. Did you see that?
I did see that.
Architecture.
What? Ridiculous. And like how to kind of, you know, deflate an entire like new potential market for you within, you know, what was that, 27 words?
Mm.
Just ridiculous. But I think the thing is that they can't control what people do with it, but we need to have the functionality to be able to engage in the way that we really want to, and the way that was so valuable for Twitter. Well, you know, like we just never seem to get bored talking about Twitter, even as the car crash keeps on happening. You're right, Dave. A lot of car crashes in slow motion, and let's hope that Peter Dutton's leadership continues to be so.
Maybe people will just go back to reading books.
Some of us never stopped reading books, Charles. We just don't read them as much.
The latest book scan figures would say that you're wrong.
Oh, well,
it's been
but,
a disastrous well, 6 months for
oh,
for
really? The last yeah. But what yeah. book talk as well?
About, are you talking about physical books?
Or yes, physical about, books, bookstore books.
Oh, bookstore books. Yeah, but there's just, you know, there's
you
a
know
huge,
about them?
I mean, yeah. What's that? Is it? See, Dave owns a book.
See,
I have a book, look.
Yeah, Johan Hari.
Halfway through.
Stolen Focus.
He's got a book. I've got one or two books myself. So physical books are... physical books are sort of passe. Is that what you're saying?
Or? Yeah, yeah. No, I was literally talking to the CEO of Schwartz Media, actually, because The Chaser and The Shot published through them. Yeah, she was just saying it's a disastrous.
Oh, disastrous!
It's been
last
a disastrous
six months
for booksellers, like across the board. Like,
oh dear. Yeah. Oh well, I'm doing my bit. Much to my partnership,
books. Not reading them, but buying them.
Yeah, so that's not digital though, because I've probably, God knows,
Amazon's getting all our money.
Yeah. Well, don't buy from Amazon. Go out, support your local independent bookstore. Buy more. I'm certainly
buy a copy
my
of the Shot anthology.
Yeah, because there's lots of great writing in there, just not anything by me.
Oh fuck!
Yes,
buy dozens of the Shot anthology and send them to your family and friends.
Yes,
like I did.
or buy lots of copies of The Voice Handbook by Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien and disseminate
Very
them
good.
Widely, yes. which I have been doing through the little
and
libraries.
Lovely illustrations by Kathy Wilcox.
Absolutely lovely.
Yes. And a very quick plug for myself.
Oh,
or
yes.
Just wait another couple of months and buy thousands of copies of my novel.
I am very excited about your novel.
Is
it
coming
Ronnie?
Out this year?
I don't think so. I doubt it. I've been well, hopefully, fingers crossed.
Been tantalising us with little excerpts on Twitter, and I think there's a whole very enthusiastic readership waiting to rush out and buy that one. So we will happily promote
I might
that.
Listen on social media, who knows? But yeah, quick plug.
Absolutely. Look for that. Look
this
for
isn't
that.
The ABC, go nuts. Charles, you've just launched a show, I see. Pre-sales available now.
On that note, thank you all very much for listening to us for one more week, and we look forward to coming back again next week.
Yep. See
Thank
you soon.
You.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Our gear is from Rode. We are part of the Iconoclast Network.
Ooh. Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.